Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I am thrilled to welcome Jim Daly to the show today. Jim is the president of Focus on the Family and host of its daily radio broadcast, heard by more than 6.2 million listeners a week on more than 1,000 radio stations across the United States. Jim, I am so excited to have you on the show today. I'm so glad that this worked out.
It's great to be with you.
And Focus on the Family has been one of our favorite organizations for years now. I love the mission. I love what you guys are doing. So,
thank you.
But we got a lot of things that we want to talk about.
Sure.
So I just want to go on and jump in. Let's do it. All right. So I'm very interested in you talking about your story growing up, because I really do believe for our listening audience, those people who have not heard that story, I think it's going to be inspiring. I think it's going to be just really relevant for maybe where they are today.
Yeah.
And that where you start doesn't mean that's where you end up, right?
No, I appreciate that. I think for me, I was the most unlikely candidate to lead Focus on the Family because I came from such a broken home. So it was also what attracted me to work at Focus on the Family because mm-hmm. of that pain. You know, so often that great statement, people kind of move out of their pain and that becomes their passion. And I think for me, broken families, it hurt to be a kid who had such great difficulty growing up. Kind of a normal dysfunctional family, as I call it. Uh-huh. My dad was an alcoholic and my mom tried to keep it all together. I was the last of five kids. I was 6 years away from my closest siblings. They were all born 1 year apart. So I was the tattletale, the blackmailer. You know, I saw you smoking. Better give me a dollar. I'll tell mom.
Oh, that's funny.
And I worked that pretty well, actually. You know, I think kind of normal in that way. And then when I was 5 years old, my dad was arrested after threatening to kill my mom. You know, that was the end of our family. I remember mm-hmm. watching my dad being put into the squad car. The policeman came into my bedroom, put his hand on my chest, I think to make sure I was breathing. And then I'll never forget because he said, "How are you?" And I said, "Fine." You know what? You know, little kids, I was five. What do you say? I don't know.
Am I fine?
You're the policeman.
Sure.
But it really did. It totally changed, obviously, the course of the family. And so my mom remarried 3 years later to an ex-military drill sergeant. His name was Hank. I nicknamed him Hank the Tank because he was really brutal. Not physically, but just emotionally. He expected.
Well, he was military.
He was military. I mean, he did a white glove test every Saturday morning.
Right.
And my two sisters, you know, they were kind of in charge of some of the interior home stuff. And so it was a dreadful day every Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he made me hang up my jacket 500 times when I think I was 8 years old. And I was so naive. He was in the kitchen. I could have just yelled out the number, right? One, wait a couple seconds, two. But I did it. I hung up my jacket 500 times. If you go into my walk-in closet today with Jean, my wife, my side of the closet, it's pretty good. Shirts and pants and everything's organized.
Everything color-coordinated.
That's
yes.
the effect of Hank the Tank in my life. But he was married to my mom for about a year and a half, and then my mom became ill. I didn't know what was happening. I'm 9 years old at this point, and basically Hank would lock her in her bedroom and told me not to bother because I would drain her energy. So I'd go weeks at a time in my house with my mom, never seeing her. And then I remember one time my mom, she was awesome. I mean, she had a great sense of humor. And I remember She called me into her room one afternoon, and the door was just ajar. She must have gotten out of bed. And I hadn't seen her in a while, and it kind of shocked me when I looked at her because she was very frail. Mm-hmm. But I still didn't know. I'm only nine. I wasn't sure if it was a bad cold or the flu. She was actually dying of colon cancer. And she asked me to go plant flowers outside of her window. She had a flower box, and it was empty. So she said to go run and get a piece of paper and a pen. I did, and I came back, and she said, okay, write my favorite flower down. I'm like, what is it, roses? She said, no, it's chrysanthemums. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's a big word.
Right.
But I went and got the flowers, planted them, watered them once like any good nine-year-old boy would do. And it was about 6-7 weeks later she passed away. And we got back from the funeral. Hank came out of the bedroom, bags packed. We didn't even realize it. He just said goodbye. I really can't take the pressure. And he got into a cab that we didn't even notice was on the curb on our little Eagle Street in Long Beach, California. And he just drove away.
And you were 9 years old.
I was nine. My brother Mike was 19. He hugged me 2 hours later, had to go back to his ship that was taking off for Vietnam. And then Dave and Dee and Kim and I were
left to figure out what to do.
So three of us moved into foster care. I can remember in the chaos of that moment, though, I remember the day when Hank left, the day of my mom's funeral. I remember going to the flower box, and the flower shoots were up. So my mom, even in that, I mean, my mom sent me a message that I caught as a nine-year-old boy, like, your flowers were bloomed, just keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. So she just had that great instinct about how to communicate a message.
Sound like
that
a wonderful
was my mom.
Woman.
She was.
Oh, wow.
I miss her. I only had 9 years with her, but
yeah.
She gave me so much. It chokes me up because she gave me so much
in that 9 years
to know about what is good in life.
Yeah.
And she did a good job. She accepted the Lord the day before she died.
Is that right?
And it was really awesome. You know, she taught me a lot. The golden rule, that was really important to her. And lots of great stories. I remember one, the funny one. I remember I hated being alone or being lost. And we were at Crawford's grocery store in Southern California. I was probably 6 years old. She was there checking corn. You know, peeling the skins
making
back.
Sure
making
that
sure,
the
yeah.
Corn's
and
big.
So I said, I'm going to get a toy. Will you be right here? And she'll be, I'll be right here. Don't worry. I said, okay. So I ran to find some G.I. Joe outfit or something.
Uh-huh.
I came back and I was looking down another aisle, and there she was down this aisle. And I ran up, probably just that rage of everything. I never really hit my mom, but I ran up behind her and just thudded her right between the shoulder blades. Black paisley blouse, black slacks, and she turned around. It wasn't my mother.
Oh.
I had, like, totally thumped this woman.
Oh,
just bang. And this woman turned around, and I went, oh, you're not my mother. And she said, I'm glad I'm not your mother, kid. And I ran back crying, and there was my mom
she
checking
was still
the corn. And I'm blubbering and going, oh, I just hit a woman. I thought it was you. And she's like, what? And she made me, you know, to her credit, she gave me the kind of the wave
apologize.
To go apologize, didn't go with me, made me do it all by myself.
Yes,
and,
right.
You know, so I did it. I walked down the aisle.
That's a good
mom. And then I had to do that again. Sorry, I hit you. I thought you were my mother. I don't know about you, kid. Maybe, you know, that's fine. Get out of here.
Yeah.
But that's just, the type of parent she was. Really
wow.
Awesome. So, you know, things continued on. I ended up at foster care. It was a horrible situation. My brother and my one sister, Dee, lived in this foster care. And it was tough. They had four boys that were not in a healthy place and just lots of things that occurred. And I ended up fourth grade just walking out of my fourth grade class crying. I just sit on the playground and cry. And my teachers and everybody just let me go. And, you know, nobody out there is another lonely place. I just sit on that playground and cry and think, what's going on in my life? Why
right.
is all this happening
Why is
to
this
me?
Happening? Yeah.
So things just kept going.
Thank goodness you had siblings. You know,
it was good, but they were distracted.
Okay.
they weren't all engaged.
Right,
you know, they were pretty
they were older
distracted with their own stuff.
Sure,
but
sure.
the thing that I remember, especially being at the Reels house, this foster family, and about 6 months into it, the social worker came out for a visit, her first visit, and she's probably like 25 when I think back on it. And she looked at me and said, we've got a problem. I thought, finally, an adult that can see all the mayhem going on.
Right.
Here. And she said, well, Mr. Real told us you tried to kill him. And she was looking at me. I'm like, me? She's going, yeah. And I'm saying, well, no, I didn't try to kill him. It was bizarre. And I think it formulated, when we talk about leadership, for me, it really formulated in me a tenacity for truth. I mean, and it comes out in everything I do, and not in a terrible way, but mostly on myself, just so that I realize and understand what is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And for leadership, that's so critical.
It is.
You don't want to surround yourself with people that just tell you things you want to know. You've got to know what the truth is, what your motivations are in those things. And I think in my situation, I think God was grooming me in that way, to know as best as I could what reality truly is. And it ended up, I ended up there another 6 months on pins and needles as a 9-year-old thinking, this man thinks I'm trying to kill him. And then my dad, my bio dad, reappeared out of nowhere.
Really?
After all those years,
okay.
5 years old. I hadn't seen him that whole time. And he came for a visit and offered to take my sister and I back in with him. So we jumped.
So you did?
Oh, yeah. We moved in with him. And then my sister turned 18, and then I was going to be living with him as a 12-year-old all by myself. And nobody thought that was a good idea. So we decided, you need to tell him, Jim. He's not going to listen to us as your brothers and sisters. So we had a family meeting. I had to look my dad in the eye and say, I don't want to live with you anymore. And I remember he responded with, why not? And I thought to myself,
he wasn't in a healthy place.
Yeah, but it's hard as a 12-year-old boy to say that to your father. So I did. I just said, the way you treated mom and, just who you are today is why I don't want to live with you. And to his credit, he stood up and he hugged me and stepped back from me and said, I haven't been a good father and I wasn't a good husband. And then he died 4 months later. I never talked to him after that moment. So that's a stinger for me as well, because in so many ways, he was a good guy. Alcoholism is a disease, and it affects us in different ways, and I think he just couldn't conquer it. I wish he were still here so I could talk to him.
Absolutely. Yeah. I am sure. Well, move on and talk to us about that person that really made a big difference. I know there's at least one.
Yeah.
There's probably many.
Yeah, and I think looking back on it, that's what we have to be in community, just the investing in other people, because I was a recipient of that as a teenager particularly. And it was my football coach Paul Morrow. I had nicknames for everybody. So he was Coach Mo, and his wife was Coach's wife. We called her CW.
Okay.
And these are all nicknames I created.
That's awesome.
But Coach Mo, he really, at 15, I remember he came in, and it was his first coaching year. He graduated at Long Beach State, was a great football player in college, and we were excited to get him as a coach, but, man, he was tough. I played quarterback. He'd grab my face mask and say, if you're going to lead this team, you got to finish the wind sprints first, and you got to lead by example. I'm like, man, these guys are faster than me. But he pushed me, and he kind of called me out as a man, as a 15-year-old now. And, what does it mean to be a man? And it was the first time I had that kind of challenge. Mm-hmm. And it was really good. And through that experience, he actually, he and his wife took a great interest in me. They invited me over to their home often just to have a meal. And
just the two?
They didn't have kids.
And they didn't,
But it gave me a sense of what family could be like, interestingly enough. He scholarshiped me to go to a Fellowship of Christian Athletes camp at Point Loma in California. And at that camp, a professional football player came. He was the quarterback for the San Diego Chargers at the time. And he just talked about a relationship with God. And I went down, accepted him, and said, okay, I'll give my life to you. Now, I didn't know what that meant.
Right.
I was wobbly. I'm not coming from a Christian home. I ended up telling my dad I didn't want to live with him. I ended up moving in with my brother, who was 19.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember Friday nights for football, I'd say, what time you want me to come home? Reaching for some kind of normalcy.
Some boundaries, right.
And he'd say, I don't know, try to get home by 2-3 in the morning. I'm like 15, 16. And I remember walking out of the house thinking, I'll try to stay out that late. That really wasn't my goal.
Exactly.
12 o'clock would have been perfect.
Yeah.
It's just no boundaries whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so I wobbled along. I still made many mistakes from 15 to 22. But Coach Mo, when I look back, he was the guy.
Jim.
Financially, scholarshiping me to go to the Christian Athletes camp. And he just took care of me, watched out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife, Joyce, before they left, they were there about a year and a half at my school. And he said, I'm moving to Arizona. I'd love to adopt you and have you come with me. Which, really touched my heart. But I remember thinking to myself, that would crush my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him I just can't do it.
Right.
He went on in Arizona. He's the winningest coach in Arizona history, 390 victories. He won 13 state championships, became the 2011 National Football Coach of the Year. And I probably would have been in the pros if I would have gone with him.
Yeah.
But just a
but then
great,
you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Right,
then,
just
so
a great guy. And he was the difference maker,
if
I could say it that way. He was the guy that invested in me and changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that, Jim. And I always say, I don't think teachers or coaches get enough credit.
I agree.
And sometimes they can be the difference maker. They don't always feel that. But you just never know what that child is dealing with on the other side at home. And so I'm so glad that he invested in you.
And we're still in touch.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. So you still talk to him.
Yep.
That's great. let's transition into your career. So talk to us about your, you know, educational background and what you ended up doing, and then we can talk about what you're doing today.
Well, I didn't know. I was a little scared. I got accepted at UC San Diego and several other schools, and I ended up going to Cal State San Bernardino because it was close to my brother again.
Okay.
And I thought, but, you know, even in that, if you can imagine with me, the first Christmas break comes, and my brother's not in a good place. He and his wife are having difficulty, so I really have nowhere to go. So I had to petition the school to say, can I stay on the campus in the dorms during Christmas break, which is like 3 weeks. And they came back to me and said, you can do it, but there's not going to be any electricity.
No electricity.
I mean, cold showers. If you can get something out of the vending machines, I think they were still working, but there are no lights or anything. It was an incredibly lonely experience. It was unbelievable. And that, you know, so that was kind
of... Was that a month? I mean, because
it was almost
college
a month.
Breaks are
it
usually
was almost a
month.
You know, I did well in school. I enjoyed school. I thought that was my ticket out. I ended up going to Waseda University in Japan my last year and a half and came back with an idea for international business. Got hired eventually by International Paper and spent my early career with them. And then through a phone call of a friend, they asked if I wanted to come to work at Focus, which I wasn't too interested in the beginning.
Right.
Because nonprofit, I was thinking, why do that?
Yeah.
What's the purpose?
So International Paper, were you, we've never talked about this, but were you in Memphis?
We were out of the Bay Area,
out of San Francisco. Okay.
Yeah. Jean, my wife, is going to UC Davis, pre-vet major, and then I was working out of Emeryville. But it was, you know, it was the thing. I thought, okay, this is it. And I can remember the very day I was going to get a promotion, I came home that night after having dinner with the general manager out there, and he painted the picture for me and said, here it is. And that very night I got home, and on my message machine was this contact at Focus on the Family saying, okay, that job's been approved. It was about 10 months later, so I had kind of given up on the idea, and I thought, okay, I've got a different course.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called him Thursday the next day and said, I got to fly down Friday, and you got to let me know if you want to hire me.
Mm-hmm.
And we did all that. Friday night they called after Gene and I returned to San Francisco. And they said, here it is. And I turned down $150,000 for $32,000.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, my wife in that moment, I was mostly concerned about what she would think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a few sticks of furniture. This is this was our moment.
Right.
We were on the way up now. And, you know, when you get that offer like that, you're thinking, okay, this is what it's going to be. And I remember coming home and Gene said, you know, I just trust your judgment. I'll be with you no matter what you want to do. Just do something that makes you happy. And I thought, wow,
that's a good wife.
I married well.
Yes, you did.
And she was awesome the whole way in that regard, and I just loved it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Jim Daly. Jim, tell us a little bit about Focus on the Family, because some of our listening audience may not know Focus. I mean, we've listened to Focus and read Focus books for ages now, for a long time. That's right.
Well, we appreciate that. Focus has been around 40 years, started by Dr. James Dobson, who was a PhD from University of Southern California in child development. He wrote a very famous book called Dare to Discipline, and it kind of went up against Benjamin Spock, maybe a little more permissive parenting styles. So that was the launch of Focus on the Family, actually. Let's get involved in the culture. Let's help parents be better at parenting. And eventually, let's help marriages stay together, et cetera. So that's the core mission that we have at Focus, is helping families in every way.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a broadcast. It's 6.3 million listeners. And in that context, what we're trying to do is help marriages stay together and help them cope and do better and thrive. And then in addition to that, for those that have children, to help them do the best job they can in raising these kids. And I think when you look at the culture today, there's not a lot of great places to pick up good marriage and parenting advice. And, you know, one of our greatest competitor is Disney, ironically, because you can book your park tickets, your cruise tickets, or get marriage and parenting advice.
Sure. So,
and about 80% of it's pretty solid, actually. So it's just not accessible in the culture.
There's not a lot of places to go. Well, I just know for you guys, too, for our listening audience, sometimes when you have an issue, I know that we had a situation in our company where we had one of our employees son passed away. And the first call that I made was to focus on the family, because I said, we've never been in this situation. How should we as employers support him right now?
That's a great example of where we can help. And that's our goal, is to just be there for people.
Right.
You know, we've answered questions for 40 years, probably 10 million questions that have been put to us. And we've just built a whole host of resources and tools to help people cope.
Yeah. So if someone was sitting out there right now and saying, wow, I've got this issue, what would they do? Go to the website?
They could do that. The website is focusonthefamily.com, or they could go via the phone, 1-800-A-FAMILY. And we have counselors. We have people to help in every situation, and then resources and tools to come in behind that to help you cope and do a better job.
Well, tell me just real quickly, because I think this is so awesome. You guys actually have intensive marriage counseling.
This is one of the hottest things going at Focus
right now. Right?
Hope Restored is the name
of it.
It's typically a 4-day marriage intensive. It's 40 hours, so you do about 10 hours a day. It's grueling. It's tough, but it's been found to be the best therapeutic approach, rather than 1 day a week for 6 months or one day a month. Doing it deep and intensive for 4 or 5 straight days is really a better therapeutic approach. And we have a post 2-year 80.1% success rate. Those marriages doing better and still together. So when you're looking for a silver bullet in marriage and marriage difficulty, I think it's one of the best things going in the country right now. We're putting through about 1,500 couples a year. And we're hoping to expand that. We just opened in Michigan. We're going to hopefully open soon in Southern California. And I'd love to see 5 to 7 centers around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, helping 5,000 to 7,000 couples a year.
And it's a proven model.
I mean, it's a proven model. And these couples mostly have already signed divorce papers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the irony
mm-hmm.
of it. So it's very effective, the methodology.
Right.
And most of it is just communication and coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
People's triggers, you know, helping people better understand what gets under their skin.
Sure.
And we as human beings, we have a unique way, especially as spouses, of irritating one another.
Right.
And, right. And, you know, in God's little design, the opposites coming together is so funny.
That's right.
So the introverts and the extroverts, the dark chocolate, the milk chocolate fans. I mean, we all come together, and then we have this mayhem. And I think in the end, from a spiritual perspective, I think the interesting thing is it's to help us become more selfless.
Oh, it totally
is. We don't like those lessons.
No, we don't like it. Right, exactly.
But that's leadership again, if you think about it.
Yes.
I mean, being selfless is core to a leader.
Well, there's so much that we could talk about, and we are just scratching the surface of everything that Focus is doing. But I do want to talk about one thing, because there may be people out there, Jim, who are possibly coming from the for-profit world to the not-for-profit world. So I really do believe, that you have brought so much value and so much good to Focus because of your business background. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know when you came in, you changed a few things and, you know, getting a lot more focused.
Right. That's part of it.
Right.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'm grateful to Dr. Dobson. You know, he's the one that said, I want you to take it forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of that, he understood I had a business background, MBA. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a seminarian. But in that context, the interesting thing, I was appointed in 05. And so I had 3 years where he and I worked really well together. And then we have the 08, late 07 financial crisis. And so we had transition and financial crisis all at the same time. And we had to manage a budget. And I can remember 1 year, I think it was the 09 budget, going to the board and suggesting we take a $15 million reduction, which meant a lot of jobs.
That's a tough call.
That's a tough call. In nonprofit, it's very similar, in my estimation, to government and higher education, universities. There's a certain entitlement feel that goes with nonprofit. I can remember making a call to somebody who'd given $100,000 to Focus, and I called him, which I like to do, and this man said, you know what, Jim, I just expect you to run Focus effectively and efficiently so my wife and I can do our ministry through you. At first, I was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? That's
makes
exactly
sense.
Right. And
right.
I repeat that over and over now with the staff at Focus on the Family, because that is our goal. That's my responsibility. How do we run it effectively and efficiently? So we put a lot of numbers in, a lot of metrics that I brought them from the business world. What are we trying to do? What are we trying to hit? And then let's measure ourselves.
Sure.
There was a bit of pushback on that. And I think that, again, is another nonprofit reality. It's you know, it's hard to measure, but you actually can. And let's measure what we can measure and then make adjustments to be more effective at what we do. That's true of your own life if you want to be effective, and it's true of anything you might run. Those are things that you need to do is know where you're going and right. measure if you're getting there. I mean, if you were to jump in a car and just take off, it's pretty mindless.
Right.
You got to know where you're going.
Absolutely.
And are you making progress?
Right. Yeah. And that's precisely what you've done.
Right.
So goodness gracious, we could talk so much about that. I'd love to hear more about just life and draw on that. But I do want to talk about, this is called Something Extra. So I would love for you to talk about something extra that you feel like you brought to the table that helped you do well in your role, or something extra that you admire in someone else. So you can
handle
those. Okay.
I'll give you a positive and a negative.
Okay, sure.
How about that?
Sounds
it's always good.
Good
to self-disclose.
Yeah.
I'll start with the positive.
Okay.
I think one of the things I learned in taking on the leadership role of Focus is how I was prepared as a child. I'm always brought back to that point, even what I mentioned earlier about being accused of trying to murder my foster father. It did give me this desire to understand what is my environment, what's true about my environment. I think that's a really important leadership skill, mm-hmm. and you don't want to surround yourself with yes men and women and sycophants who just think you hang the moon all the time. And you got to really work at encouraging people to give you the straight facts, especially if it involves you. I am constantly telling my C team, you got to tell me because I mm-hmm. want to be better. So don't just talk amongst yourselves about something
right.
that I've done,
come to me and
a stupid mistake, whatever. Mm-hmm. You have complete permission to come and talk to me. And then I've got to fight the urge to retaliate. That's my job.
Yeah.
And sometimes that urge is there.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
You don't understand the reason I did that.
Uh-huh.
But I think that understanding the truth. And so the good thing that I learned that I feel in my leadership capability is I learned it as a child.
Mm-hmm. And you have a passion
also
for
that,
the truth.
And also that tenacity. I remember in the transition, it was tough. You know, I'm grateful to Dr. Dobson, but we all knew it was going to be bruising for everybody. And I give him great credit that he accomplished it. There were a couple of times I said, take it back. I don't want to do this anymore. But I felt like the Bozo the Clown that keeps popping up with a smile on his face. You know, I get knocked down and I pop back up. And that's true. And you just have to have that resiliency mm-hmm. to say nothing is going to keep me from the goal. And it doesn't mean you're ever disrespectful or anything like that. The background as an orphan gave me resiliency. And if you can use that wisely, it's very productive.
Powerful.
You won't be moved off your spot. You just have to make sure you're on the right spot. And then the downside, probably confidence. I think what I lacked was confidence coming in. When I played quarterback in high school, same thing. I remember my coach, mm-hmm. Paul Morrow, when we would have those talks, he said, you know, you're coming from a deficit, so you don't think you're good enough. And I get that because you're an orphan kid and you got all this problem going on. But he said, you got to trust your skills. But I think even going into that role as president of Focus, first of all, we prayed for a year for the poor guy coming behind Dr. Dobson, you know, because we knew it was going to be tough. But the skill set and all that, of course, he has a PhD from USC in child development. He was lauded and wrote Dare to Discipline, sold millions of copies. So I turned and fussed that whole night before the investiture service and said, Lord, you know, you got the wrong guy. I didn't sleep a wink that night. And I remember the whisper in my heart was, it's not about you.
Mm.
It's about what the mission of Focus is. So just be a good steward of that. And I think that's true no matter where you're at in your faith journey or whether you're running a company or a nonprofit. That's the human condition. Can you be a good steward of this mission? That's the challenge in leadership.
Well, very good. So, Jim, I want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything exciting coming up in 2019 that our listeners need to know about, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about that a little bit.
I appreciate it. Yeah, we have right here in St. Louis, for those that are close by, we're going to have a date night with Greg and Aaron Smalley. It's going to be a fun, lighthearted event. Husbands come thinking it's going to be some, you know, theological thing. And, you know, geez, you're going to drag me to that. But it's not.
Talk about my emotions.
It is totally fun. And people walk out laughing and having a great time. And so that's going to be right here in St. Louis, and we'll get more of those details
to
everybody.
That's wonderful, yeah.
You know, generally at Focus on the Family, the thing I would plug is if you are hurting in any way in your marriage as a single or as a parent with a child who's struggling, get a hold of us. Focus is an incredible resource center for people. And I think sometimes we undersell that. And that would be the plug, that if you're hurting in your family, call us. Let us help you. We count it a privilege to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And we've done that ourselves. So mm-hmm. I can attest to the greatness of what Focus is doing. I wish we had hours and hours more
to do this.
It's a great
topic. I love it.
Yeah. Well, it's so wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you, too.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.